Glenn Youngkin against mask mandates, Trump versus DeSantis, and the synagogue hostage taking. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zan de Sanctis, and the sage of authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Masterworks and Ball and Branch Sheets. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So Jim Garrity, we got Glenn Youngkin inaugurated on Monday. We're recording Tuesday morning here and gave a wonderful inaugural address, I thought encapsulated the message of his campaign, uplifting, unifying, and with a real emphasis on cost of living and, importantly, parents and the respect they are owed and the raising of their children and the education of their children. This was a big emphasis of Youngkin's. Probably if you want to identify one thing, it's the reason why he got elected, because obviously Terry McAuliffe stepped in it repeatedly on this issue. And then he delivered on his first day with an executive order saying that parents have the right to opt out if their school districts have mask mandates. What'd you make of it?
Look, talk about hitting the ground running. The mask mandate's going to get the most attention, but we probably shouldn't gloss over, he signed executive orders and actions that ended the use of critical race theory in public education, rescinded the vaccine mandate for state employees, withdrew from something kind of the regional greenhouse gas initiative. This is one of those, climate change working groups among states. And he directed all state agencies to cut the number of regulations by 25%. Busy first day. But the thing, at least in my neck of the woods, that has generated the most drama, the most contentiousness, the most anger, is his attempt by executive order to say, all right, schools, if a parent doesn't want their kid to wear a mask, the parent has the right to send their kids to school without a mask. Now, this immediately got pushback from certain Democrats in the state argument, and I think I checked it out. They're correct. In 2021, Virginia passed a law declaring the schools must provide in-person instruction, but they must, quote, to the maximum extent practicable, use currently applicable mitigation strategies approved by the CDC in schools to reduce the transmission of COVID-19. Now, that law doesn't specifically say masks, but Fairfax County, Arlington, Alexandria, Richmond, I think Henrico County are all saying, look, as far as we're concerned, the CDC is still recommending masks for kids in school, regardless of vaccine status. And thus, we are going to keep the mask in place. Students, you still have to wear them. I think they're right on this. I'm sure they'll have a big, long legislative fight over this. Ideally, the state legislature would alter that legislation and clarify it to say if a parent doesn't want their kid to wear a mask, they don't have to wear a mask. I don't know if that would pass. As I mentioned, House of Delegates is controlled by Republicans by a narrow margin. It's 21-19 split in the state Senate, but it's worth noting the fact that there are 21 Democrats in the state Senate doesn't necessarily mean the Democrats are going to have 21 votes to do everything they want. Some of those Democrats represent these Northern Virginia suburb districts, and maybe they'd feel pressure from their constituents to vote a certain way on this. Worst case scenario, Glenn Youngkin can get a vote on this, and he can get every Virginia Democrat as saying, no, parents, you don't have the right to decide whether your kid wears a mask. Obviously, that's not the victory he'd be looking for, but I think that'd be the next best thing. And Democrats, I think, would be dreading heading into a midterm election year.
So, Zan, it's clear, and this has been obvious for a while, that masks have become this quasi-religious totem. There is just zero evidence that, especially with young kids, they make any difference whatsoever. In fact, the CDC did an enormous study last year that no one heard about because the CDC kind of did everything it could to minimize and bury it, showing there's no difference whatsoever that you get from masking or not masking. And this is one of those areas where a lot of people just aren't aware of what an outlier we are in terms of other advanced Western democracies. Most European countries have not done anything the way we have, masking every kids of all ages in the schools. The European equivalent of the CDC doesn't recommend doing this. 12 and above, it recommends masks, but not for young kids. Same thing with the WHO. But you say, okay, let's have let's allow dissenting parents to not mask their kids if they don't want to. And you have Zen Psaki and others pretending like this or acting like this is like going to endanger kids and public safety and is the worst travesty they've ever encountered.
I know, it's utterly absurd. And we've been seeing things like this for a while, but now it's come to Virginia since we finally have a sane governor in office. I was really encouraged by his entire inaugural address, but especially by the different executive orders he put in place on his first day. And this one in particular, I think he followed through on something he said he was going to do during the campaign, even though he had to know there were going to be parts of the state where he was going to get a lot of pushback, right, you know, on day one. He did it anyway. So that was encouraging. But as you say, the science is 100% on his side. There's absolutely no reason why you would need to have children in masks all day. And his order, by the way, didn't say parents may not put a mask on their child, right? He didn't say, I never want to see another child in Virginia wearing a mask. He moved the authority where it belongs, to parents. And if parents don't think there's any reason why their kids should be wearing a mask in school, then they shouldn't have to put a mask on their kid. Their kid shouldn't have to wear a mask. And, you know, in addition to the point you raised, Rich, about how this doesn't actually do anything in terms of stopping kids from transmitting or getting COVID, two additional points, one of which is kids actually don't get very sick from COVID. They usually don't contract it, or they contract at a much lower rate. And if they do get it, they're basically always totally fine, right? So maybe the people we're supposed to worry about are teachers, but surely all the teachers in Virginia who are complaining about this are, you know, double, triple vaccinated, perfectly, you know, safe from the disease, and have a lot of them probably also have gotten COVID already. So the idea that teachers are now the ones who are worried about themselves once again, and are now trying to inflict on kids whose parents don't want them in a mask and who know that they don't need to be wearing a mask, more mask wearing, indefinite mask wearing for some unknown reason, is absurd.
So, Charlie, have you gotten a chance to look at all at the legal questions that Jim raised? Because it's not obvious that Youngkin has the authority to issue this executive order. There's a statute, as Jim, that Jim just referred to, saying that the schools need to stay open, but need to the maximum extent practical, hew to the mitigation strategies outlined by the CDC, that is still like a ridiculous age 2 and above should be mask recommendation from the CDC. But then you have this, you had Northam, though, feeling compelled for whatever reason, actually on top of that statute to issue an executive order mandating masks, which if it were clear on the statute, you think you probably wouldn't have to do that. And then there's another part of the Virginia code that stipulates that parents should have the chief responsibility for the welfare of their children.
From what I've seen, this question is unclear, partly because the statute in question is limited or ambiguous, and partly because there are conflicting parts of the legislative canon. And as usual, I will side with legislatures rather than executives in such a case. I would rather see our executives bound by caution than assume a broad reading of legislation. So I am absolutely open to the idea that Youngkin does not have this authority. What I think is perhaps more interesting than that in the long run is that the politics have changed in Youngkin's favor. Now, that doesn't affect the statutory question at all. If Youngkin lacks the authority, he lacks the authority. But I don't think that the political class, many of whom live in Virginia, has yet caught up with what has happened in Virginia and in the country at large. And what has happened is that the more hysterical policies that were just outlined have gone from being broadly popular, as they were a year ago, to being broadly unpopular. And listening to the manner in which Youngkin's approach is being criticized is really funny. He's being cast as an extremist, almost as a cheat who pretended that he was this fleece-wearing moderate, and then revealed himself to be one of those terrible death cult Republicans, which of course is not true. Youngkin is trying to achieve what he promised that he would achieve. He is trying to do as governor what he ran on during the election. And if I were him, I would now try to take this to the legislature. Unless I'm wrong, Jim, you'll correct me. The Republicans are in charge of the House of Delegates. Is that correct?
Correct.
And as such, his allies in the Republican Party can introduce a bill to this effect and put other members of the House of Delegates on record and put the Senate on record as well. I would do that if I were him. If he realizes this is going nowhere, if he loses any court cases, if his further analysis reveals there's no statutory authority, I would take this to the state legislature. Because if you look at the pattern of this pandemic, legislatures are far more careful. They are far more reluctant to impose sweeping rules than agencies are. Almost all of the excessive rules, regulations, limitations, shutdowns have been the product of agencies, of executive branch officials interpreting or overinterpreting or usurping legislation. I am not convinced, despite the state senate in Virginia being, I think, still run by Democrats, I am not convinced that Youngkin would lose if he made a push for this. And if he does lose, I'm not at all convinced that it would hurt him politically.
So, Jim, let's delve into masks a little more broadly. You had this extraordinary statement in your Jolt yesterday, I guess it was, on Youngkin and masks from Leanna Wen, who has gone up in the world from being a chill for an organization devoted to killing unborn children to just being a COVID alarmist, which is much better. But she at every juncture of this pandemic, when in this role of hers, mostly on CNN, she has favored, unless I'm mistaken, the most extreme possible restrictions. And then she said the other day, cloth masks are not appropriate for this pandemic. It was not appropriate for Omicron. It was not appropriate for Delta, Alpha, or any of the previous variants, because we're dealing with something that's airborne. We're dealing with a virus that is extremely contagious. So this is becoming, you know, the conventional wisdom. So we've now had three iterations of the conventional wisdom, at least from the so-called experts. The first, you're an idiot if you're wearing a mask. Do not wear a mask. It won't do any good. And then they told us subsequently they were only saying this to protect a mask and keep them for medical professionals. And then for about 18 months or so, maybe more, it was, you are a heretic, you are reckless, you don't care about yourself or anyone else if you don't wear a mask, to now, well, actually, the masks that most people have been wearing the entire time basically do nothing.
So I would dispute on a microscopic level that Leanna Wen has always promoted the most extreme positions. I think obviously not a fan of her past work at Planned Parenthood, and she has taken some really outlandish positions. I think my favorite one, September 2020, she writes in an op-ed in the New York, in the Washington Post, very big difference between the New York Post and Washington Post, saying that there's a difference between going out and protesting at a Black Lives Matter rally and a different one from going to a pro-Trump rally. I guess, look, the virus could go to a Black Lives Matter rally. Apparently that's the virus is racist. Maybe that's the best way of summarizing it. But that having been said, when I saw that, you know, quote on CNN and, you know, not just the contention like, oh, Omicron is super duper contagious and masks don't work as well against it, but the notion that cloth masks have always been useless against that, my inner Adam Sandler was raging and saying, this is information it would have been great to have 2 years ago. We've had people fighting in stores about whether or not they're wearing cloth masks. People said there's a security guard who stabbed somebody in an altercation about whether they were wearing a cloth mask. And now we're told, you know what? Cloth masks were never any good at all. Really, you know, because the other, you know, factor in all of this is if cloth masks are, as she used the term, facial decorations, besides the fact that we have wasted so much time and energy and you know, emotional stress and confrontation and all that stuff over something that ultimately was useless. Right? That's, you know, like, if that's the case, everybody who's been, you know, giving each other grief about not wearing a cloth mask, never mind the thing that looked like a knit sweater that Alyssa Milano wore early on in this pandemic, they owe everybody else an apology and a recognition that, oh, sometimes the science, or science, as they keep insisting in all capital letters in Gavin Newsom's tweets, recognize that sometimes the science isn't always so clear. That sometimes, you know, it's not, you know, that it's not a story of heroes and villains and everybody who disagrees with you is a bad person who wants people to have COVID and things like that. No institution in the country wants to get into the business of checking whether the people in the store or the office building or the school or anything else like that, whether their masks are cloth masks or whether they're N95s or whether they're 3-ply or anything like that. This is the next step. People are going to try to say, well, if cloth masks, facial decorations, clearly we need to ban them and we need to, you know, send out the mask police to make sure everybody's got a 3-ply instead of a 2-ply. You know, no matter what, if you look at the District of Columbia, December 21st, they instituted one of the strictest mask mandates in the country. Basically, every indoor building mask. Only time you're allowed to take it off is eating and drinking, because the virus pauses when you're eating and drinking. It's very polite that way. It doesn't like to interrupt you when you're chewing or anything like that. The idea is, you know, they did it. And since December 21st, 37% of all cases in the District of Columbia have occurred since they enacted that mask mandate. Mandates do not do a darn bit of good against Omicron. Oh, by the way, you know, I mean, I hope everybody out there gets vaccinated. I hope everybody out there gets boosted. But even if you're vaccinated and boosted, Omicron is still going to use your body to get around like it's O'Hare International Airport. It's going to transfer. It's going to jump around. Like, you know, almost everybody in the country, I exaggerate when I say almost, but like lots and lots of people have gotten sick since like January 1st. And what it was is everybody traveled to see their families for the holidays. Everybody was, you know, traveling, everybody's getting together, but some people got together for New Year's Eve celebrations, stuff like that. And then everybody comes home and they've got that cough. Now, ordinarily, you'd be like, okay, well, I'll just test and see what it is. Well, some people could find tests, some people could not. So they didn't know that tickle in the back of the throat or the cough. Is it a cold? Is it the flu? Is it COVID-19? In a lot of cases, it was Omicron. And they went around, they went into the office or they interacted with people and they ended up getting it. So that's why you end up with like 8,000 new cases a day. I think it's going to clear out, you know, gradually. Some people think we're peaking. It's probably going to peak at different points in the country. Big East Coast cities may have hit their peak so far, but all in all, I think it's going to continue. So as much as I would love to have made fun of the Biden administration for sending out all those COVID-19 tests after the Omicron wave, my guess is we're still going to have a whole bunch of people who are dealing with Omicron back in, as we get into February.
Suzanne, exit question to you. How bullish are you about the governorship of Glenn Youngkin? Very, somewhat, a little, not at all.
I'm very bullish, I would say, and I didn't like what he was selling early in the campaign, but after seeing the way the campaign ended, his win, and then his first couple of days here, I'm very encouraged.
Charlie?
He seems to be behaving as governor as he promised he would behave as governor when he ran, which is a good thing.
Based on the first 48 hours, we can reach this conclusion.
Well, I think we can, because he did two things. He gave a speech in which he outlined his plan, and he issued a raft of executive orders. Now, obviously, being something of a hawk on executive power, I hope he proves to respect the Constitution of Virginia. And we will see how that plays out. But his politics seem to be solid.
Jim Garrity.
Rich, for the first time since I moved to this state in 2007, I am disappointed that my state has a one-term limit for its governors. Mm-hmm. The moment you take the oath of office, you're a lame duck. So because of that, I would, you know, based on the first couple of days for Glenn Youngkin for another term, and I look forward to doing so in the year 2029.
I'm going to go with Vary as well. I think he is arguably the most important Republican in the country now, not named Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis. It's just very important to see whether he can succeed in this populist tinged, you know, and cultural war tinged, but not entirely about either of those things. It's a kind of a standard Republican message updated for the times. And if he can make this work in Virginia, it might become a very important model. With that, let's pause and hear from our first sponsor this episode, Masterworks. Feeling like you've hit a wall with your investment strategy? Or maybe you've been burned by the stock market too many times since the start of the pandemic? What if I told you that you can invest in a resilient alternative asset class that the elite have been quietly putting their money into for centuries? I'm talking about, of course, blue chip works of art. Artwork that outpaced the S&P from 1995 to 2020. And while it used to be inaccessible to the everyday investor, that's no longer the case. Masterworks is the $1 billion startup securitizing the once exclusive art market, allowing you to finally add iconic paintings from masters like Banksy, Picasso, and Basquiat to your portfolio at a fraction of the cost. And right now, Masterworks is giving you priority access to their newest offerings. Start putting your money to work at masterworks.art/editors. Again, that's masterworks.art/editors. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer. Please check it out. So, Zan, we've had a spate of stories about Trump-DeSantis tensions. We have reports privately that Trump is irked at DeSantis because DeSantis hasn't bent a knee, that DeSantis hasn't said that he won't run in 2024 if Trump does run, and Trump has been running him down as dull, supposedly, and lacking personality. What do you make of it?
Well, I'm a little surprised that all of this is coming up so early ahead of 2024. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious to everybody that DeSantis would be one of the main contenders against Trump if people do indeed decide to run against him. And if Trump decides to run again, it's obviously not clear. You know, DeSantis hasn't said for sure whether he would run at all, let alone if Trump is running too. But he does seem to be doing all the things that Republican governors or Republican politicians do if they're gearing up for a run. Of course, he has to first win his reelection campaign, but Charlie would know better than me. I don't think he's in particular danger of losing. But I find the whole thing very interesting, and the way DeSantis is handling it is interesting because I think it looks like he might run even if Trump did, right? Because if he was going to bow out, if Trump came in and said, I'm planning to run, and expected the rest of the field to kind of fade away and treat him as an incumbent, DeSantis probably would be doing what a lot of other Republican politicians have done, which is act like they'd get out of the way, right? Or act like they're friendly with Trump. And I'm sure he'd prefer Trump not to outright attack him. But the way he's being cagey about it and not really saying one way or another, not really talking a lot about Trump at all, suggests to me that he would run anyway. I find that encouraging. I mean, of course, I personally hope Trump doesn't run at all. But if he does run, I really don't want every other Republican politician who might run to go away. I also don't want all 25 of them who might want to challenge him to do so. But I would hope that DeSantis at least would be one of the ones to stick around.
So, Charlie, all this stuff is based on anonymous sources, but obviously kind of accords with what you think Trump's attitude is. And we saw a little public eruption of this a week or so ago where Trump did an interview and was talking about vaccines and boosters and said that he got boosted. But there's certain gutless politicians out there who won't say whether they got boosted, even though they did. Clearly a shot at DeSantis, who has turned cagey on this issue. And as we discussed a little offline, I really thought this was kind of a classic Trump pincer movement. I don't know, you know, maybe it's accidental, maybe it's instinct, whatever. But Trump just has his genius for putting people in an awkward position, because if DeSantis continues to be asked about this and continues not to answer, well, then a lot of people will think, okay, there, Trump is right. He is gutless. But then if he turns around and starts answering this question, gives an answer to this question, then people say, oh, look, he's weak and got pushed around by Donald Trump.
Yes, I think DeSantis should just have said what his vaccination status is. He's been pretty pro-vaccine, albeit opposed to mandates, throughout. I suspect that this is partly political maneuvering from DeSantis and partly the product of his own messaging. He has leaned pretty hard into this line that Florida will not become a biomedical security state. And part of that is an emphasis on privacy. And I suspect that his refusal to answer that question is related to that. But I think he made a mistake here that Trump is exploiting. I think it's interesting that Trump thinks he needs to exploit these weaknesses this early, in that DeSantis, insofar as he is attacking Trump at all, or at least insofar as he is saying things that could turn into attacks on Trump if he runs against him, is doing so from the right. Oddly enough, Donald Trump may find himself being attacked during the primary as someone who failed to achieve his promise. I can imagine Republican candidates saying, well, you talked a big game on big tech, but you did nothing.
Mm-hmm. You elevated Anthony Fauci.
You elevated and indulged Anthony Fauci and tolerated lockdowns. I mean, this one I'm about to mention is, of course, preposterous and ugly. But I even saw a candidate in Arizona attacking Trump on election integrity from the right. Now, this is evil, but it was clever evil, because this candidate clearly wants to pretend that the election was stolen, which it wasn't, but also wants to differentiate himself. And so what he said was, well, the election was stolen. Trump knew it was going to be stolen, and he didn't do anything about it.
You know, Charlie, that's interesting, because I do think from a certain point of view, Trump's own depiction of himself is of an incredibly weak loser, right? You get cheated, like no one else has been cheated out of the presidency except for you, and you can't do anything about it ahead of time or during or afterwards.
Right, right. So I think Trump is trying to shore himself up, because unlike the press or any, you know, Charlie Sykes style candidate, you're not going to see Trump being attacked from the left. If anything, you're going to see him being attacked from the right. On the broader question of whether DeSantis will run, I of course have no idea. I have never spoken to the man in my life. I don't know him. I do know that this is his moment. 6 years is too long. And I think that if DeSantis wants to be president, then he's going to have to win re-election this year, which at least now seems relatively likely, given Florida's tilt and how good the prospects for Republicans seem. And then he's going to have to work out how to run against Donald Trump in a primary. I know the temptation will be stay out of that. Don't allow yourself to be tarnished. And we've already seen, or at least we've heard through leaks, some previews of these attacks. DeSantis is boring, is weak, so on. Trump will do that. But I don't think in 6 years, the country, the political landscape, the Republican Party is going to look the same. So not that he's asked for it or would, but my advice to DeSantis would be, if you want to be president, run and let the chips fall.
So, Jim, this just goes to one of the many problems with Trump still having such an outsized role. Here you have this guy who lost to Joe Biden, right? Just one of the weakest general election candidates we've seen since Hillary Clinton, right? And here he is threatened by wanting to diminish, and will do everything he can, push comes to shove, to stomp on one of the brightest rising stars in the party, who, by the way, wants to take, you know, what was good from Trump and synthesize it and carry it ahead in a really potentially, you know, compelling and productive manner.
Rich, Donald Trump's biggest problem with Ron DeSantis is that Ron DeSantis is not Donald Trump. That's what he believes. That is his criteria for success. Ron DeSantis could be the most successful governor in the country. And by the way, I think Charlie might argue that. I think a whole bunch of Republicans, I think a lot of Florida Republicans would argue they've got the best governor in the country. And that wouldn't matter one whit to Donald Trump. Donald Trump's focus is Donald Trump, period, full stop. You notice his critique is not really on DeSantis's policies, even though he lives there. When you listen to what Trump says about DeSantis, or at least according to these leaks, you never hear him say, you know, he could have done this on taxes or.
Yeah. It's not like it's threatening to move to, you know, New York or California, out of California, right? Out of Florida, yeah. Because it's so misgoverned.
His critique, by the way, is that, you know, that DeSantis is boring. Hey, America, doesn't boring sound really good right now? Are you enjoying
DeSantis is boring.
You know,
he's right.
Inflation, you know, the pandemic that, you know, Trump said he was going to shut down, and gas prices, food prices, the open border, all that kind of stuff. Wouldn't it just a competent, quiet, president who you have to worry about? But think about the joy. The first time since, like, probably in my mind, like 2007, 2008, but maybe in your minds it goes back, where you wouldn't wake up every morning thinking, God, what is the president going to do today? God, you know, and you like that sense of dread. What's the president? How is the president going to try to transform America today? God, imagine if we had a president who wasn't trying to fundamentally transform the United States of America, who wasn't promising a revolution, who just, our government's got a lot of duties. It's done a really lousy job on those duties for a long time. I, as head of the executive branch, are going to try to make government work better. Right. When I promise there's going to be 500 million tests for COVID, I'm going to try to make sure there are 500 million tests for COVID. I'm going to do my best to make sure they don't get to you on like the tail end of the spike in cases. You know, boy, that'd be real. And Trump's problem with Ron DeSantis is his personality. Is it lively enough? This isn't a reality show. Go back to hosting The Apprentice if that's what you really want to do. Governing is not entertainment. So I think it's very revealing about Trump that, you know, he couldn't come up with, it's not a policy issue. And then their objection, of course, is loyalty, that, you know, DeSantis hasn't demonstrated enough loyalty, or, you know, of course, loyalty to Donald Trump is that you know, if he ever helps you in any way, and indisputably Donald Trump did help Ron DeSantis by endorsing him in the primary, by doing that, you owe your life to him. You must never critique him. You must never object to anything he does. You must always agree with him. You must certainly never. And in this circumstance, you must clear the field for him. You are doing something wrong by not promising, I will not run. Look, Ron DeSantis has got every right to run for president. I mean, he should take care of his gubernatorial reelection. I think he will get reelected governor, but I think it's a bad look for anybody to have that this closely associated to presidential campaign speculation before they've won or in the second term. So my guess, my guess is Ron DeSantis will run against Donald Trump. I wouldn't count him out yet. I have a sense that Republican patience with Trump is waning month by month, year by year, but still a lot of road ahead between now and then.
So Jim, I take your point in theory about boring and boring president, but people just, they don't get elected by being boring. I mean, Biden was the exception and it was solely because of Trump. But the fact that Biden was boring went to political deficiencies of his that have hurt his presidency. But I do take your point that it's a bizarre attack on someone to call them boring. You know,
I'm not sure I agree with that, Rich. I think we had two presidents in a row who weren't boring, or at least who excited people, and Obama and Trump. I think in the modern era, a lot of boring presidents are elected, and it depends what comes before them. Jimmy Carter was boring, and George H.W. Bush was boring, and George W. Bush was boring, and Joe Biden's boring.
No, I think we think of Jimmy Carter as boring, but he was like an exciting, charismatic new personality when he was running. Had the X factor. I give you George H.W., but that didn't turn out well. And not necessarily because he was boring.
But it didn't turn out well for Trump either, and he certainly wasn't boring.
Well, that's true.
Or Jimmy Carter.
Trump was way over on the other side of the scale, obviously. I've been thinking a little bit about Carter's legislative failure, because it's really interesting, because I wanted to make a comparison between Biden's legislative failures and Carter's legislative failures. They're both failing, but they're failing in totally opposite ways. Because Carter was this, you know, self-righteous guy who knew no one, was a genuine outsider. You know, he ran an outsider campaign on the heels of you know, Watergate, where that was really appealing, and just never got along or established a working relationship with congressional leaders. So nothing happened. Now Biden, you know, the COVID relief bill happened, the infrastructure happened. Those are substantial things, but he's not getting anything done, even though he's joined at the hip with Pelosi and Schumer, and that's a product of Pelosi and Schumer being in the grip of the same delusion Biden is, that they somehow have an agenda, a mandate to do this big stuff, or failing that, at least should try to do it because they're not going to have any other opportunity to do it. So Zan, exit question to you at this juncture, who is likeliest to be the next Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis?
Oh man. Well, I think Trump is making a lot of noises like he is at least keeping the option open of running. And I fear that if he does run, he'll be the nominee. But I'm not totally convinced that he's going to run. So I guess I'm equivocating a lot. I think probably Trump is slightly more likely at this point.
Charles C.W. Cook.
I find this difficult because I think that my perspective is warped by being in Florida, where most people I know who vote Republican have moved from Trump to DeSantis. I think it also depends on how many people run. And if you get 30 candidates, Trump's going to win because he's just going to go straight up the middle. I would say at the moment, I think it's about 50-50 between DeSantis and Trump. I can construct scenarios in about equal proportion that lead to each of them winning.
Kim Garrity.
I am a few notches over from where Charlie is. I think probably about a 60% chance Trump, 39% chance DeSantis, and maybe 1% somebody else.
So I think the answer clearly is Trump. Because I think if Trump runs, I can't see DeSantis running. I think Charlie's view is the correct one. You want to be president, you just got to go this time. And you know, maybe you're stomped by Trump, and he dents your image and reputation such that you can never do this again at a national level. But you're unlikely to be as hot ever again, regardless. So the risk is worth it. But I'm not sure whether he's going to think of it that way when push comes to shove. And just Trump, it's just going to be a reduced field if he runs. And maybe, you know, at times I've agreed with Charlie on this, that his grip is loosening, maybe imperceptibly, kind of day by day, but loosening. But there's not a ton of evidence right before our eyes at the moment. So if he decides to run, and I think it's probably more than 50% chance that he does, not guaranteed, he has a really strong chance of winning the nomination. Whereas if DeSantis runs, and I'm stipulating he does that in a non-Trump environment, you know, there can be 12 people. And I do think this boring thing is a problem in winning a nomination. And that's the big question in my mind about DeSantis. Does he have the performative ability? And that remains to be seen. But I think the answer is Trump. And with that, let's go to Charlie for a big endorsement of Ball and Branch Sheets.
Ball and Branch Sheets that have, of course, been used by 3 presidents. We'll have to find out whether Ron DeSantis has them as well, and then we'll know whether he's going to make it to the White House. But if you dream of comfortable sheets at a price that won't keep you up all night, look no further than to Ball and Branch. Ball and Branch makes the softest organic sheets on the market, and they get better with every wash. And comfort isn't their only standard. They use 100% sustainable raw materials. And as the first fair trade certified manufacturer of linen, you can feel as good about your Boll & Branch sheets as they feel against your skin. And they do feel great against the skin. I know, because I sleep on Boll & Branch sheets every night, ever since we got a set and my wife decided that they would be where we would spend half our lives. The signature hemmed sheets from Boll & Branch are a bestseller for a reason. They have buttery, soft, lightweight, organic cotton in a classic sateen weave for sheets that get softer over time. They're not too hot. They are not too cool. They're the perfect year-round sheets for most sleepers in most locations. Boll & Branch focuses on quality over quantity. No inflated thread counts here, because more isn't always better. And Boll & Branch signature sheets come in 7 beautiful colors in all sizes, from twin up to California King. Made to a higher standard, 100% organic cotton, ethical production, and a thoughtful attention to every detail. There's nothing worse than fitted sheets that don't fit. Ball & Branch offers 17-inch deep fitted sheets and labeled sides to help you make your bed beautifully every time, because the little things make a big difference. And best of all, Ball & Branch gives you a fair price, plus a 30-day risk-free trial with free shipping and free returns. So if you want to experience the best sheets you've ever felt, go to ballandbranch.com. And if you do, you can get 15% off your first set of sheets when you use promo code EDITORS15 at checkout. That's Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com, promo code EDITORS15.
Thank you, Charlie. Please check it out. So, Jim, we had this hostage situation in Texas at a synagogue. Thankfully resolved without anyone being harmed except for the hostage taker himself. Always better to capture these guys alive. That was not possible. He was shot dead, and some real heroes in that synagogue. But notable after action, and we've just seen this time and again for years and years and years now, is whenever there is a Muslim involved in one or has been a perpetrator of one of these incidents, everyone all of a sudden becomes really reticent about attributing any motives when obviously an element of the motive is completely clear. You know, that this guy wanted to, was on a madcap mission to spring this woman affiliated with Al-Qaeda from jail, from imprisonment, and goes to a synagogue to try to do it. You know, there are other details that you want to know, but how much more do you need to know in broad brush to make some very simple and obvious statements about what was going on here, but you have the media and authorities reluctant to do so?
Rich, you know, listeners to this podcast, by the way, I believe this is our 400th episode. Good for us.
It is.
The listeners of this podcast probably have noticed
that feel like more than like 390 to me.
Yeah. We don't look a day over 392. The Federal Bureau of Investigation doesn't have the greatest reputations, thanks to a lot of the, you know, Russia investigation and Peter Strzok and things like that. And, you know, some of that criticism is unfair, but a lot of it is pretty fair. And so when you heard about this and you heard that the hostage rescue team out of Quantico gathered all their stuff, flew down to Texas, went in, rescued the hostages, took out the perpetrator, it was really great to see. It was, you know, one of those great unvarnished victories. You know, say this is what we have an FBI for. Thank God they were there. Thank God everybody else got out safe. And you're ready to feel really good about it. And then Matthew DiSarno, who was the special agent in charge of the FBI Dallas field office, is doing this press conference with these comments, you know, and he says, "We do believe from our engagement with this subject that he was singularly focused on one issue, and it was not specifically related to the Jewish community. But we are continuing to work to find motive." Now, thankfully, the FBI backtracked on that statement. But the idea that this guy would attack a synagogue, and it's just completely unrelated, you know, he's as if he had taken it at random, right? Oh, he was looking for a church, but he just couldn't find a church in Texas, so he had to settle for a synagogue. Come on. And he called the rabbi, making his demands of his release of this Al-Qaeda operative. I know it's going to shock people, but I think a lot of Islamists are actually anti-Semitic. It's really kind of shocking. You know, they tend to believe the Jews control the world, and the Mossad and the Israelis are behind everything, and all that kind of stuff. So the idea that an Islamist terrorist, somebody who's acting out of a religious sense of jihadism, it's not stunning me that they don't like Jews. And then, you know, following up the next day around midday, this all, you know, shakes out Saturday night, where, you know, a lot of us are watching the football games and checking Twitter and getting these updates. And this sounds like an absolutely terrifying situation. We all remember the shooting in Pittsburgh. We know there's a chance this is not going to turn out well at all. Sunday, you know, we have a bunch of the basic stories. And I know it's going to shock you, listeners, but President Biden had a statement that was kind of garbled and didn't make a lot of sense. But I think the statement that, and he really said he didn't want to speculate on the motive of this of this gunman. And it didn't, that part I didn't like, but even more bizarre was he says, I don't think there is sufficient information to know about why he targeted that synagogue or why he insisted on the release of someone who's been in prison for over 10 years, why he was engaged, why he was using anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli comments. We just don't have enough facts. Call me crazy. I think the fact that he was using anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli comments gives you a hint as to what his motivation was. I think the guy hated Jews. Why is this controversial? Why are people afraid to say this? Why, you know, why is it that, you know, when this sort of thing happens and it's a, you know, right, you know, anti-Semitic white nationalist nut job, we learn about that quickly. You know, nobody has any problem rushing to the microphones to denounce that. But when it turns out to be somebody who's a jihadist, all of a sudden everybody's looking at their feet. It's very, very close-lipped about this. It's kind of like, hey, remember that? It's almost like we've heard nothing about what's going on with the guy who drove his car to that Christmas parade up in. People know this. People can see this. And it's just utterly bizarre that, I don't know whether it's the fear of cultivating hate crimes against Muslims or something. I don't know what's driving this. But there's this ludicrous double standard to the point where people are afraid to say something blatantly obvious. A guy who attacked a synagogue because he wanted to get an Al-Qaeda operative released. Guess what? The guy's anti-Semitic. Newsflash, film at 11.
So, Charlie, there's a friend of ours who moved from the Northeast down to Florida, freer country, freer state, easier to get a gun, and goes to synagogue, you know, every Sabbath, and immediately acquired a gun and talked to the rabbi about it, and the rabbi encouraged him. And there are people packing who go to these services every weekend, exactly because they're fearful of, you know, some sort of white nationalist nut like we saw in Pittsburgh or some sort of situation like this, and something that held the rabbi and folks in that synagogue in good stead. There had been a lot of training that they'd undertaken for exactly this sort of situation, which is, you know, it's great that it helped them get out alive, but it's really depressing that it's necessary in the United States of America in the 21st century.
Oh, I don't know if I agree with that. I think the story, unfortunately, of Judaism has been this for thousands of years. I don't know why we would expect it to be different in America or in the 21st century. It's always been depressing, and I suspect it always will be. And as such, I would urge people to defend themselves. I mean, I think a lot of synagogues do defend themselves, especially on Shabbat. This one seems not to have, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, there were only about four people in there because they were live streaming. Second, told that there are differences in approach. Had this been an Orthodox synagogue, it would be much more likely that someone would have been armed or there would have been an armed guard. The interview with the rabbi in the New York Times was slightly annoying to me, I must confess, and this is in no way to take away from what he did. He was there, I wasn't, but he talked about the training he'd had, which sounds great, and I would encourage people to get it. And he said, you know, it's just like CPR. You probably won't need to use it. You certainly won't need to use it every time you leave the house. But it's really great just to have it in a crisis in case. And I thought, you know, that sounds quite a lot like a particular tool Americans are fond of that's constitutionally protected. And this was put to him. What about guns? Do you wish you'd had a gun? He said, no, because I wouldn't have been able to use it before. I'd have been shot. Well, he was there, I wasn't. But he then said that he threw a chair at the guy and ran 20 feet out of the door. And I think if you can throw a chair at a guy and run 20 feet out of the door, you could probably use a firearm. Anyhow, the likelihood is there will be an increase in people carrying, and there will be an increase in security. And I do agree with you that that's sad, but you know, I just don't think it's new. This is an age-old problem. It's the biggest problem still in America. If you look at violence that is committed as a result of ethnicity or religious belief, the vast majority of it is anti-Semitic. It is wonderful that this ended without without loss of life. The one thing I would just add at the end here is this guy shouldn't have been in the country. But the details are still a little bit murky. I know Andy McCarthy's working on a piece on exactly how this happened. But the guy had a criminal record in England, and he had been on a terror watch list. I think he was dropped from the terror watch list. He was a former subject of interest. But his criminal record should have kept him out of the United States, as far as I understand it. And I think the Biden administration made some changes as to how we evaluate people coming in. And if it turns out that those changes help this guy get in, then we should review that. Because if you listen to British authorities, there was no doubt whatsoever that this guy was bad news. He had been kicked out of...
His brother say, I'm shocked that he was able to get into the United States.
Yeah, I believe he was from Blackburn, which is in the north of England. And he had been kicked out of a courtroom there for saying that he wished he'd been on one of the planes on 9/11. So this wasn't a surprise. This wasn't the perennial guy, oh, no one had any idea. He flew to the United States, I think, in early January. You know, President Biden, I think, will try and turn this into a gun control issue, but it's not one, really. It's an immigration and border security issue at root.
Sam?
Well, I think most things have been said about this already. I just don't. I would echo especially what Jim pointed out about how it's almost impossible to understand why it's so difficult for people to admit that there's anti-Semitism at root when these types of things happen. I mean, there's obviously a lot of bias going on. Same with what we saw in Wisconsin when the news cycle moved on after a day of a guy, you know, ramming a car into the crowd for very obvious nefarious reasons. And I'm not one to say that we should immediately rush to judgment as soon as we know the skin color of the person or the name of the person who did something horrible like this. I always like to wait till there's enough information. But once there's enough information, we all kind of know what happened. And yet there's the same crowd every time, prominent, very prominent people, the media, in this case, even the FBI, who don't want to admit that. And I think it's, you know, reprehensible.
So, Jim, let's go to another topic, exit question style. We had this podcast interview from a partial owner of the Golden State Warriors. I guess maybe more of an investor is the way to put it, even though on his Twitter bio, he proclaims himself an owner of the Golden State Warriors, saying that no one cares about the Uyghurs, saying other reprehensible things about China. So exit question to you. The kowtowing to China that we've seen from sports leagues, especially the NBA, from various aspects of the business community, will become unsustainable over the next couple of years and change. Yes or no?
By the way, it is Chamath Palihapitiya. A while to try to get that.
Now you're just showing off. You're just saying the name because he can, right, Jim?
Thanks. Well, wrote all about it this morning, and I was struck by the fact that everybody, because this paid attention to the snippet about him saying he doesn't care about the Uyghurs in China, which is a bad thing to say, and he should feel ashamed for saying that. But what's even worse is that as the conversation goes on, this is not one of those things like, oh, it sounds, but it was taken out of context, as a bunch of people tried to contend this morning. No, the entire conversation is terrible. It just gets worse and worse. I think the part that really jumped out at me, though, is that he said that people who are, you know, quote, you know, until we actually clean up our own house, the idea that we step outside of our borders with, you know, with us sort of like morally virtue signaling about somebody else's human rights track record is deplorable. So he's much angrier about people who call out China on its human rights violations than he is angry at China itself for committing the human rights violations. By the way, using the word deplorable, I just find a really fascinating loaded word to use there. I have now ranted about Rich. What was the question?
So this become unsustainable, this kind of thing, this sort of kowtowing next.
Well, he's already issued a "I'm sorry if anyone was offended" statement.
That was the most cowardly apology. Yeah. It was extraordinary. He pretended that he'd been somehow misunderstood or come across wrong, or the tone had been misreported. And then he issued a statement that didn't mention the Uyghurs or say anything about it at all, had no connection to what he had said, as if it was some sort of walk back. It was so weak.
So, by the way, I also think the context that is relevant to him is not just as owner, you know, apparently a minority owner of the minority as in stake, not minority as in owner of the Golden State Warriors. He's a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. And I think what, you know, we shouldn't just see him, oh, because of the NBA and this. I don't think he's being influenced at this by LeBron James. I think he's being influenced by this, by the attitudes in Silicon Valley, that China is this massive market. And if pretending to not notice ongoing genocide is the price of to that market, that's what you do there. He's getting some good pushback, but clearly, like, I don't think NBA commissioners put out a statement yet. For all extents and purposes, this community is pro-genocide if it, you know, maintains market access.
So, answer to the X question, this will be sustainable in a couple of years. Yes, sir.
Short answer is I don't know. But I'm not feeling optimistic.
So after that huge lead-in, we get, I don't know, from Jim Garrity. Zan.
I suspect it won't totally stop. And I think there's just, for a lot of these people, there's kind of a very obvious profit motive. For some of them, maybe it's ideological, and they just really don't like America, and they take it out on us by trying to pretend like China's fine or we're just as bad or something. But I think there's also there's just profit motive for a lot of these people. And, you know, there's people like Inez Kanter and others who are trying to make it stop or at least make them look bad for doing it. But I'm not sure that if the profit motive doesn't change, they'll change.
Joy Cook.
I'm not sure either. I do think there's a special place in hell for people who come from other countries, become immigrants in America, do well, and then talk down the place and compare it to China. And he's the Ilhan Omar of Silicon Valley, as far as I can see. And I hope he's not representative.
So I'm going to say, I guess maybe this is terrible. Maybe I'm going to take a pass on my own question as well. So unsustainable is kind of a strong word. I think it's become less sustainable as our conflict with China becomes clearer, as China's conduct, I assume, becomes even worse, and we see a move on Taiwan in some form or other. It's going to be harder to maintain this sort of posture, which is totally appalling, and just an amazing cultural and propaganda victory for China. I mean, what feats of subversion did the Soviets attempt to get the American business community on its side during the Cold War? And you know, and they got various activists and dovish democratic politicians, you know, de facto on their side, or at least against doing the things that were necessary. But to have so many leaders in American society unwilling to say the truth about China is just astonishing. And I do think it'll become less sustainable over time. Bonus exit question to you first, Zan, because I know you're so eager to answer this one, even more eager than Jim was to answer the question about kowtowing to China. Who will be in the Super Bowl a couple weeks from now, both from the AFC and the NFC?
Well, I'm just happy that it's not going to be the Patriots. I'm a Giants fan, and since they're so terrible, my last remaining joy in the NFL is to root against the Patriots. But I'll say I think it'll probably be the Packers and the Bills.
Packers and the Bills. Charlie Cook.
Well, as you know, Rich, because we've talked about this, I actually am, I think, far more bullish on the Titans.
I'd be really, really thoughtful about this one.
No, I'm more bullish on the Titans than you are. I don't know why. I just think they keep winning, and I wouldn't be surprised if they kept winning. And then I think the Packers as well will make the Super Bowl this year.
All right, Titans, Packers, Super Bowl. Jim Garrity, yes or no? Packers, Titans?
Since late in the season, I've been forecasting Packers and Chiefs, and that is still a plausible option here. I just want to point out, didn't everyone enjoy Saturday night watching the Buffalo Bills just absolutely obliterate Bill Belichick and ensure that we won't have a Bill Belichick, Tom Brady Super Bowl? My understanding is that was the worst loss for a group of American Patriots since the Battle of Long Island.
Saving that up, haven't you, Jim? It was a disappointing wild card weekend. The games were close, were kind of barely close because there were these last ditch comebacks that didn't work out. And otherwise, they just weren't competitive. So I got to go. I think it's the Packers coming out of the NFC, and I got to do the head heart thing. Head says Chiefs, heart says Titans. I'm guessing I got to go with the Titans. They've been kind of lucky all year long. I think they can beat the Chiefs if everything breaks the right way. So what the heck, I'll say stuff's going to break the right way. And it's Packers, Titans. Although it wouldn't have shocked me if they just lose.
So we had no votes for the Bucs.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I thought we would have at least one Bucks vote.
All right. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Zan, you're embarking on a new book project.
I am. I'm writing a book with my co-author, Ryan Anderson. It'll be out this June, hopefully around the same time that the Dobbs decision comes down. The book's about abortion. Of course, I'm sure our listeners won't be too surprised to hear that if they read my work at NR, but the book basically says, yes, you know, we all know abortion harms the unborn child, but let's look at all the other ways it's devastated our society too. And the aim is so pro-lifers can make a very comprehensive case against abortion once Roe v. Wade is gone and states can make their own laws. You know, make a, obviously the case against it because it kills the unborn is important, but there's a lot more to it. So listeners can pre-order that, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, those sorts of places.
So, Zan, congratulations. That's very exciting. Good luck on it. But Thanks. This is a light item that will make it impossible for you even to have the light items you've had previously. You're not going to Pittsburgh when you're working on a book.
It's true.
So now, from here on, ask me, I worked on my book this weekend.
Setting up my desk again.
So, Jim Garrity, you watched Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Yeah, this was one that didn't catch in theaters, looked good in the trailers, got delayed a bunch of times because of the pandemic. Now, for those who have breakout in hives at the, you know, god-awful Lady Ghostbusters reboot from a few years ago, this is completely different. This was directed by Jason Reitman, who is the son of the director of the first two Ghostbusters movies, Ivan Reitman. If you haven't seen it, he made this really cute little video about what it's like to work on a film series that your dad created. And apparently he had his dad, you know, on set a bunch of times, you know, and inviting him over. And he said, boy, if you think your job is, imagine we having your dad looking over your shoulder every day and clearing his throat and giving you an indication of, it's not the way I would do it. It's really funny, really heart-filled, very much about family, very outside of the tone of it. Yes, you do see the old guys come back in cameos, but just a great, fun story about a family kind of rediscovering and, you know, what makes them unique and special, and had a lot of fun watching it with the folks last night.
Charlie Cook, big trip to Disney?
Absolutely. This has become something of an annual tradition. We go for my youngest's birthday. He is a spoiled little boy. And it was just absolutely terrific, as usual. Kids loved it. The highlight was that we got to try out the new ride at Epcot, Remy's Ratatouille Adventure, which is based on the Pixar movie Ratatouille, and combines these giant sets with 3D video and these ride vehicles that aren't attached to anything and can spin and rock and move and so on. It's very, very clever. And if anyone is planning on going to Disney, I would make a beeline for that. It's in the France section of the World Showcase at Epcot.
So this should end any legitimacy I have in mocking Zan's not particularly exciting light items. But I got a new bird feeder. So that was the big event here. I had a little bird feeder, squirrel buster, that's extremely effective. Anyone wants to foil squirrels out there, as far as I can tell, the squirrel buster bird feeders are fantastic, but I had a 1.3 pounder or whatever it was. So every single day I was having to march out there and refill it with my black oil sunflower seeds. And this was not such a nice jaunt as the weather turned incredibly frigid. So instead I got this bazooka of a bird feeder, more than 5 pounds. And it tipped over in a windstorm the other day. And I figured, okay, I'm going to go out and just get my shepherd's hook back up straight in the ground. And everything was completely frozen solid. So this bird feeder is still on the ground. Not the birds don't seem to mind. They're still exhibiting a huge appetite for these sunflower seeds, even though it's not standing upright. But that's my big event, Zan. What do you think? New bird feeder.
Yeah, no more mocking, but that is pretty fun.
So it's that time in our podcast for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Yeah, it's really good that I always go first, so I never have to be, you know, fuming that someone else selected the one I was going to do. My colleague, Charlie Cook, did Republicans pick the right time to lose? They're, you know, usually when you like the idea of winning a particular election being a poison chalice, I'm sure a lot of people come back with the Vince Lombardi quote, you know, you show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser, you know. But there really is kind of this fascinating dynamic going on here that the Democrats, more than anything, wanted to win the presidency in 2020 and that they'd take office in 2021. And I guess they figured the pandemic would go away and the economy would recover and everything would be great. And it hasn't shaken out that way. Now, a lot of this is because of the policies Democrats have chosen to enact, energy, you know, taxes, giant spending bills, dumping more money into the economy with, you know, ignoring warnings about inflation. But look, if 2021 and 2022 are destined to be a really lousy stretch for the country, you don't want to be the incumbent party. And so it looks like things could be a phenomenal red tsunami of a year. So I hadn't thought about it that way. And I think Charlie really makes the argument in a much more plausible and intriguing way than almost anybody else would do.
All right. Congratulations, Charlie. You are plausible and intriguing. Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is the latest in a great series we have here at NR called Forgotten Fact Checks, written by Isaac Shore and Brittany Bernstein. And in this particular piece, they cover both the press joining Biden and overlooking the anti-Semitism of the Texas hostage taker and some of the worst responses to Youngkin's first day on the job.
Charlie Cook, what's your pick?
Well, my pick is a bit older than the others, but that's because I wasn't on the last episode. So I'm going to pick it anyway, in the hope that no one did this last time.
Mine's old too, so I'm wondering here.
My pick's Carl Smith's Old Man Yells at Cloud. Was that yours?
No, it wasn't. Someone picked that last week when I think when you weren't here, but go ahead, pick it again.
I'm picking it again. This is classic Kyle. It's funny. It just runs on and on. You can't stop reading it. And he makes a great point halfway through, in the midst of being amusing, that Biden's is going to be the second straight presidency destroyed by Twitter.
So my pick goes even further back. I don't think anyone got this one because it appeared right around the end of the year when we took an episode off. It's by one of our young writers, a guy named Nate Hawkman, the graphic obscene material sparking a parental revolt in the schools, making the really important point that, you know, we hear a lot about these book bans, but the books that people are targeting by and large are really a problem and have, you know, obscene material that's fine for adults if they want to read that kind of thing, but really inappropriate in schools. And this piece is hard to read at times. I admit I did not read the whole thing. I skipped through a lot of this because it is so disgusting and disturbing, but it's really important context in a debate that's gotten attention and will continue to do so. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zan. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to Masterworks and to Ball & Branch Sheets. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.